Thank you, Father. So, I would like to do a quick recap of last year for those of you that were not here last year for the conference on music. We talked about basically music in general. What kinds of music are forbidden? What kind of music are acceptable? What kind of music is good? And that's basically a judgment call for each individual, though there is, of course, an absolute standard. Now, the highest form of music is, of course, that music that has been used and encouraged by Holy Mother Church. And that is what the conference this afternoon is going to be about, is the sacred music that we have the privilege of hearing in our own churches. And I have to say it's a wonderful advantage. Certainly a topic that could be talked about often today is technology. An advantage of technology is that we can listen to this music not just in church, though that is its proper place, but we have it available on these fancy Spotify and Amazon Music and all of these things. So we can really be inspired by the music of the church. Now I would like to talk about music historically, but really through the eyes of the popes. As Father Gabriel just explained to us eloquently, by the church, we understand most often the popes. There is an incredible amount of legislation in the church only on sacred music. I would like to first read to you from Pope St. Pius X, and this is from his motu proprio on sacred music, Tra le sollecitudini. He says, and this is basically, we're speaking about music, sacred music, being a complementary part of the solemn liturgy, participates in the general scope of the liturgy, which is the glory of God and the sanctification and the edification of the faithful. It contributes to the decorum and splendor of the ecclesiastical ceremonies. And since its principal office is to clothe with suitable melody the liturgical text proposed for the understanding of the faithful, its proper aim is to add greater efficacy to the text in order that through it the faithful may be the more easily moved to devotion and better disposed for the reception of the fruits of grace belonging to the celebration of the most holy mysteries. And so right here we have the basis, the foundation for what sacred music must be. It is a powerful tool in our pursuit of heaven, that it can help to sanctify us by furthering devotion. So as I mentioned, the church has taught extensively on sacred music from the time of the apostles. So this is just going to continue to flip as I speak. This is a summary. This is not an exhaustive list of church legislation, but these are papal documents only on sacred music. From St. Paul, we have, be filled with the Holy Spirit, speaking to one another in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs. That's from Ephesians chapter 5. Pope St. Clement, who was the successor to St. Peter, spoke about the use of chant, specifically in the sacred liturgy. And so, from, again, the time of the apostles until our own day, we have a continual teaching. Now, with these, it's still going. With these papal teachings, there are two different types of teaching, and this is true with much legislation of the church. We might consider what is a preceptive law versus what is a directive law. Now, a precept is a law that contains strict orders, and it must be obeyed. An example of a church law that is a preceptive law is that all Catholics, at least over the age of 7, must abstain from meat on Fridays. There are specific exemptions from this, but it is a precept of law. It is not just a suggestion. On the other hand, we have a directive law, which we might take, for example, Pope Leo XIII in his encyclical Fidentem Piumque Animum, he urged all Catholics to pray the rosary every day. That is not binding under sin, but it is a strong recommendation, and we should listen to the Pope, but not strictly binding the conscience. And so with the papal documents concerning sacred music, we will see both preceptive and directive laws. But what is beautiful, there is an astounding continuity. There is a unity in all of the opinions, all of the documents issued by the popes throughout the centuries. What exactly is the purpose of music? And then also to give a directive, these directive laws, as to the style. What should it sound like? And we'll get into that in a few minutes. But beginning with what is the official music of the Catholic Church, we have, of course, what we know now as Gregorian chant. Now, it's a sound that should be familiar to all of us here. Sometimes it's not an arresting or catchy melody like we like to have in our modern music, but this Gregorian chant is indeed very ancient and the most perfect example of what church music should be. It comes indeed from the Jewish tradition of chant at sacred events, and it was used by the Catholic Church. It was perfected and used by the Catholic Church. Again, Pope Clement, the successor to St. Peter, said that chant ought to be used and sung by the faithful at liturgical functions, and conversely, the sacred texts and this holy chant must not be sung in any profane setting. So we see all the way from the time of the apostles, music being used to praise Almighty God in an official way. This continued to take form over the centuries, primarily in Rome. There were other places where chant was fostered. But always the popes were coming back to chant in the Roman tradition. In fact, it's interesting, there was a document from Pope Leo IV in the 9th century. There was an abbot who had introduced into his monastery a type of chant that was not in the Roman tradition. Pope Leo IV wrote to him personally, threatening excommunication if he did not return immediately to the Roman form of chant. So, carefully, we see the popes keeping that unity. And this was again in the 9th century. We know most famously Pope St. Gregory the Great he collected and also promoted more than any other pope this style of chant. And he is given, of course, we attach his name to chant. Great an influence he had on this form of music. So there are many documents that I could read to you about from the popes on Gregorian chant, but in the interest of time, we'll try to keep the pace going. Nevertheless, it must be stated, and this will have a lot to do with the rest of the types of music we talk about, Gregorian chant is the official music of the church. All other music that was allowed and is allowed to this day has to reference itself to Gregorian chant. Now, more recently, Pope Saint Pius X issued that motu proprio. I mentioned this was November 22nd, 1903, and this is his crucial motu proprio on sacred music, Tra le sollecitudini, where he yet again collected and reorganized Gregorian chant. There was, at the time, what was called the Ratisbon edition of chant, but it was discovered to have deviated in certain ways, and it was not acceptable to this great pope who had such an intense love for music. He decided to place the care of Gregorian chant in the hands of the Benedictine monks of Solesmes, France. And so these Benedictine monks set about the great task of basically redoing the official Vatican editions of Gregorian chant. And that is what we, to this day, have in our own churches, the Liber Usualis. But I would like to read, before moving on to the other types of music I would like to discuss, I would like to read to you two paragraphs from this motu proprio of St. Pius X. He says, "Sacred music should possess in the highest degree the qualities proper to the liturgy, and in particular sanctity and goodness of form, which will spontaneously produce the final quality of universality. It must be holy and must therefore exclude all profanity, not only in itself, but in the manner in which it is presented by those who execute it. It must be true art, for otherwise it will be impossible for it to exercise on the minds of those who listen to it that efficacy which the Church aims at obtaining in admitting into her liturgy the art of musical sounds. But it must at the same time be universal in the sense that while every nation is permitted to admit into its ecclesiastical compositions those special forms which may be said to constitute its native music, still, these forms must be subordinated in such a manner to the general characteristics of sacred music that nobody of any nation may receive an impression other than good on hearing them." And then he goes on to discuss different kinds of sacred music in reference to, again, this Gregorian chant. St. Pius X says, "These qualities are to be found in the highest degree in Gregorian chant, which is consequently the chant proper to the Roman Church, the only chant she has inherited from the ancient fathers, which she has jealously guarded for centuries in her liturgical codices, which she directly proposes to the faithful as her own, which she prescribes exclusively for some parts of the liturgy, and which the most recent studies have so happily restored to their integrity and purity. On these grounds, Gregorian chant has always been regarded as the supreme model for sacred music, so that it is fully legitimate to lay down the following rule. The more closely a composition for church approaches in its movement, inspiration, and savor the Gregorian form, the more sacred and liturgical it becomes. And the more out of harmony it is with this supreme, that supreme model, the less worthy it is of the temple. The ancient traditional Gregorian chant must therefore in large measure be restored to the functions of public worship, and the fact must be accepted by all that an ecclesiastical function loses none of its solemnity when accompanied by this music alone. Special efforts are to be made to restore the use of Gregorian chant by the people, so that the faithful may again take a more active part in the ecclesiastical offices, as was the case in ancient times. Now, for those of you that are members of your parish choir, maybe even organists or directors, let's take an honest appraisal of our own attitude here. We just heard the voice of the Pope. I think it is fair to say very often, okay, we're going to have a pontifical high mass. Well, let's have all the bells and whistles, pull out all the stops, as they say. We have to have the biggest, grandest, loudest mass we possibly can, and that will make it perhaps more solemn. That is not what the saintly Pope just told us. This Gregorian chant, I believe in many of our parishes, has lost its proper place. It should be the foundation. Any parish choir that is capable of producing any other kind of music should first be able to sing Gregorian chant properly. And this much is stated very even more clearly later on in this motu proprio and then also the encyclical of Pope Pius XII. But I think we have that understanding very clearly. Gregorian chant must be the foundation of sacred music. Now, we can expand quite a bit from here because the church does allow other kinds of music. But I wanted to have this very solid understanding. If we are trying to choose what is worthy of church and what perhaps is not, the popes have given us an absolute standard. So I'd like to talk next about a kind of music that has been given the full approbation of Holy Mother Church, but with certain conditions. And this is what is known as polyphony. Classic polyphony is the term given to this music by St. Pius X. Because there are abuses that have crept up over the years regarding this style of music. You can trace the history from Gregorian chant to this kind of music. And it started very simply. You have the single melodic line of the chant, and then perhaps another line would be added as a simple harmony. And then they thought perhaps, well, what if we sustained one note for a long time and then sang the melody above that, and started to, as Father Benedict explained in his lecture this morning, this style of music progressed slowly, and it reached its zenith during the High Renaissance in the 16th century, particularly with composers like Palestrina. But it's interesting that in some of the best examples of polyphony, there is a direct correlation with Gregorian chant. And I'm going to play for you this version of Ave Maria that is written for five voices. And you'll probably recognize the Gregorian melody for Ave Maria. I'm sure that's one that you've heard before. It's amazingly clever, because Palestrina uses this Gregorian melody in each of the lines at different times. We'll see if we can get this to play here.
Ave, 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 ave.
etc. So we can see how the popes would say this. This is inherently beautiful music, and you can trace it just even, you know, with your own ears to the Gregorian chant, even using the melodies from Gregorian chant. But the style remains, even though it is much more, I would say, much more involved. Still, this was given a very high place by Pope St. Pius X, and he encouraged those choirs that are able to sing this style of music that it should be done. However, some grave abuses started to happen here. There were some really unfortunate scenarios. So, some of the main problems, the text, because of the complexity of this form, the text could be obscured. It would reach a point where it's just so much going on that you can't hear the words anymore. And if we recall from Pope St. Pius X, he said, is that not the primary purpose of sacred music? It is to clothe with suitable melody the liturgical text. So I want to give you another example here. This is a famous piece by Thomas Tallis, who was a composer in England. Complicated history with Elizabeth I of England, but he wrote this piece called Spem in Allium, which is a 40-part song, 4-0. There are 40 individual voices here. So it starts out reasonably enough, but you'll see how quickly it devolves. So you can still hear Spem in Allium. Even if you knew Latin well, this kind of music is not according to the mind of the popes, because the whole point here is to encourage the faithful to greater piety. And granted, the sounds might be nice, but it's the text that is to be advanced from sacred scripture or from the missal or from the Roman breviary. So this was a problem, and the popes, the fathers of the Council of Trent, saw this becoming really a dilemma. There was, we'll get into how it was ostensibly solved, but Palestrina had a part to play in it, no doubt. Another abuse that was happening, especially in the 16th century, was popular melodies were being included in the music. So I'm going to play for you another one, and this is a rather interesting thing here. See if you find any issues with this. This is a mass written by Lassus. So, etc. The Kyrie is another 2 minutes long. In my mind, it's actually very beautiful. It follows a Gregorian sort of theme. There was a major issue with this. It was from that main motif which is a musical set of characters that repeats in the Mass very often, was taken from a French tune that was popular at the time. And to our ears, well, okay, we don't know the tune. It was like, well, what's the big deal? So I have an experiment here, and I'm going to see how many of you I can scandalize. Pay attention. So this is something that I threw together very quickly. This is not any sort of serious music. Obviously, see if you can hear a melody in here. Extra points if you, or maybe negative points actually, if you can discern what melody is borrowed here. Oops. Did anybody get it? It's a little well hidden. Maybe it's on the tip of your brain. You're thoroughly worldly if you know this melody, so you probably don't want to. No, I'm just kidding. There's in the top part. Let me do one more time. It's only 30 seconds long, and then I'll let it continue, and you'll know for sure. Listen to the soprano line. Do you get it now? Okay, now you can maybe hear that melody going on. Any other music by Journey would probably not be acceptable in Mass at all. So, this is how disrespectful it is. So, right. So, this is why, I mean, you put in that kind of context, obviously, can you imagine the disedification of the people on hearing something like that at the Holy Sacrifice of the Mass? And what is worse, that song is just secular. This Misa Entre Vous Filles was completely immoral and immodest. So it was a terrible, terrible scandal. There were, the fathers of the Council of Trent were of a mind to completely ban this type of music because of these scandals that were going on. Among those that really were in favor of keeping it strictly Gregorian chant were Pope Paul IV and St. Charles Borromeo. But there was of course, disputation that went in favor of both sides. Just as an aside, St. Philip Neri was greatly in favor of keeping this type of polyphony. He was a great friend of Palestrina and would encourage Palestrina let's purify this type of music. And there's legend. Now, I say this is legend. Some people will recount this as absolute fact. Palestrina wrote a mass. It's called the Mass That Saved Polyphony. And we don't know the details. This is probably just putting two kind of facts together to make a nice story. But he wrote a mass, Misa Papa Marcelli, which was all of the things that the popes wanted to see in this type of music. So the text was very clear. Nothing in it was of course, it was all original in its melody and its form. So I'll just play for you a little bit. You'll probably be familiar with this Misa Papa Marcelli by Palestrina.
Gloria in excelsis.
etc. So, whatever the actual facts were, the popes decided that this music can stay, provided it has those very clear conditions, that it has to help the text, not hinder it. It has to, of course, never use any kind of profane melody. It should always be strictly sacred in all of its parts, not just text, but the music itself. And then the other point was that it should be properly performed. So there should be instituted schools where this higher form of music is encouraged and taught. It should not be performed if it's going to be performed badly. So again, this beautiful form of music has continued to this day, and we do our best to perform it. Again, it is challenging. We put the time aside and try to learn some pieces like this. Tomorrow at the Pontifical High Mass, do try to listen. We will sing a beautiful piece by Hans Leo Hassler, and this is Ave Maria Stella. And it, of course, fulfills all of the requirements of the popes, follows a Gregorian melody. It is very involved, and the students have, Father Anaya has drilled it into them very well, so we look forward to hearing them perform that. I just want to read to you from Tra Le Sollicitudini to conclude this about polyphony. Pope St. Pius X said, "Classic polyphony agrees admirably with Gregorian chant, the supreme model of all sacred music, and hence it has been found worthy of a place side by side with Gregorian chant." And that's very, of course, these are the words of the Pope. And we do our best, but it probably remains Gregorian chant for most of our parishes is going to be what we ought to put our energies into. However, we do have the third and final form of music that I would like to discuss, and this is one I need to... I took my blood pressure medication before I came up here. No, I'm just kidding. I don't take blood pressure. But this is one that can be... It can have all sorts of heated discussions. And this is what the popes have termed modern music. And in fact, I'm just going to read to you. This is from Monsignor Robert Heyburn, his book, Papal Legislation on Sacred Music, which I'm greatly indebted to Father Gabriel for lending me. This would have been almost impossible without the book. Was a marvelous resource. Father Heyburn says, "The compositions which succeeded the classical polyphony of the 16th century were classed together by the popes as modern music. This differed from the earlier works in that they included the use of organ and often orchestral instruments as well. Moreover, their style incorporated a fuller harmonic resource and a wider emotional range. The popes were conscious of the need for a regulation of the same elements which were problems in the polyphonic compositions. But the greater emotional range and the wider harmonic resources prompted the popes to insist that the singing be devout, distinct, and intelligible. Moreover, it sought to exclude all levity or sensuousness, as well as theatrical formulae or operatic idioms." So this is really in practice, it seems like this is what our parish choirs resort to. And I might say lamentably, because Gregorian chant should have the higher place. However, this is a legitimate and a very good form of music, so long as we refer it, as with polyphony, to Gregorian chant. So I'm going to do another experiment with you, and I want to... Actually, let me read from Pope Pius XII here. This is from his encyclical musice sacre. He says, we hope, therefore, that what St. Pius X rightly decreed in the document, which he accurately called the legal code of sacred music, may be confirmed and inculcated anew, shown in a new light and strengthened by new proofs. We hope that the noble art of sacred music, adapted to contemporary conditions and in some way enriched, may ever more perfectly accomplish its mission. And he goes on to say in the same encyclical, we must also hold in honor that music which is not primarily a part of the sacred liturgy, but which by its power and purpose greatly aids religion. The tunes of these hymns, which are often sung in the language of the people, are memorized with almost no effort or labor. Hence, even boys and girls learning these sacred hymns at a tender age are greatly helped by them to know, appreciate, and memorize the truths of the faith. Therefore, they also serve as a sort of catechism. These religious hymns bring pure and chaste joy to young people and adults during times of recreation. They bring pious joy, sweet consolation, and spiritual progress to Christian families themselves. Hence, these popular religious hymns are of great help to the Catholic apostolate and should be carefully cultivated and promoted. So there is no question the Pope wants us to learn these hymns for the reasons just stated, but they have to be still within the proper sphere. And we speak, of course, of the text. The text must be approved text, but it also must be the music. And there is a fine line here. This is a difficulty because the popes have taught clearly the scope and the purpose of sacred music. But we must ask, isn't music a subjective thing? That's with all arts, there's a subjective element. So what exactly constitutes respectful, decorous, godly music? And we have to remark the popes, even Pope Pius X, they have never taken it upon themselves to set actual musical rules, because this would severely hinder true art. However, the guidelines are there, and there have been many examples given. And so, with that in mind, I would like to, again, like I'm going to subject you here. I have for you 10 Ave Marias. I probably won't play all of them. And I'm going to see which ones do you think St. Pius X would allow. You know, actually, this is really a funny aside here. There was a personal letter of Pope St. Pius X, and I forget to whom he was writing, but he was laying out some of these, the practical application of his motu proprio. And he in one place just said the simple little phrase, what would Palestrina do? So he has in very high regard Palestrina. But what would St. Pius X allow to be sung in church? Now, you have already heard some of the Gregorian chant. I just want to refresh your memory with a few seconds of it.
Ave Maria,
and this is performed by the Benedictine monks of Salem. Confusing. I'm not going to play them at the same time. That would. Oh, sorry. See, I told you this technology thing. I don't have Jonathan to bail me out here, so. It will be no problem. Right there. I know we're going to be short on time, also, so this is no good. Okay, so there's that Gregorian Ave Maria. There's perhaps the melody that we're even more familiar with. This is sung, in this instance, by Benedictine sisters. Okay, now some moving on to, we already heard that Ave Maria by Palestrina, which follows the Gregorian melody. There's another one here. This is by a composer, Tomas Luis de Vitoria from Spain. So we hear again the Gregorian. And this is one, maybe you've heard this before. This is a very doable polyphonic piece, but a favorite, I think, easy to say. Let's see if this one stops. Okay, you might have to look at that picture while we continue. So, moving on, there's another one by Vitoria that's beautiful, and it's written for 8 parts, but we don't have time to listen to that. So moving on to this one. Okay, another one that we know well. Now, what we know now of Gregorian chant, can you say, does this follow well the Gregorian form of music? Absolutely. No question about it. I didn't know that was, and I didn't recognize that as part of it. But, okay. Okay, now really, this one might need a little bit more discernment here. But I really want you to compare it. So good, maybe. Getting a little fancier, but that's really okay. Little repetition. Not such a problem. Okay, I want you to hear. Okay, by show of hands, who thinks that that should be allowed in church in context of this Gregorian chant? It's debatable. This one's a little bit on the line. I think that last part there, it closed the discussion for me. Like, most of it was okay, but then we did a little bit of a modulation, a key change. I don't think so. Palestrina wouldn't do it. Okay, just a couple more, and then we have to conclude for sure. Okay. Theatrical, a little romantic. Those were some words specifically used by popes in the 19th century that they did not want in church. In fact, that was an Ave Maria by the Italian composer Verdi. And this is a direct quote from, and this again in the letters of St. Pius X. He wrote I like secular music. I admire Verdi, but not in church. So that's an important distinction there. I don't think that St. Pius X would allow it. We're trying to be distinguishing here. There are things that are obvious. We're not going to have Don't Stop Believing by Journey. That's a no duh. But these finer points, they should also be, addressed. We should try to distinguish and have to the fullest extent what is the mind of the church. So the other two, in fact, the last two were those more extreme styles. They're Ave Maria, very theatrical. I don't think we have to play those to get the point across. There's just two amusing parts here that I just want to read to you, and we'll conclude. Regarding the bad compositions by Catholic composers. I thought this was an interesting thing from St. Pius X. It says, some Catholic composers wrote their music in the spirit of piety and also tried to give a better expression to the words of the sacred text by adding music to it. If this is a good enough excuse to absolve the composers, it certainly does not save their compositions. So St. Pius X here is saying, it's not just good intention that matters here. We have to really be discerning. Pope Pius XII said, it would hardly be necessary to add warning that when the means and the talent available are unequal to the task, it is better to forego such attempts than to do something that would be unworthy of divine worship and sacred gatherings. So if you can't do it well, don't do it at all, is what the Pope is telling us. So in conclusion, we have a marvelous gift here with sacred music. It is an important part of the liturgy of our Holy Mother, the Church. This quote here of St. Augustine, music, that is the science or the sense of proper modulation, is likewise given by God's generosity to mortals having rational souls in order to lead them to higher things. Let us truly be grateful for God's gift of music, and to our wise and generous Mother, the Holy Catholic Church, what a treasure we have passed down through all of these ages. Let us do our part to cherish and protect it. May we sing always to each other, as St. Paul says, in psalms and hymns and spiritual songs, and await that day when we may blend our voices with the voices of the angels. Thank you very much.